Good evening. It's Sunday, August 20th, 2023. Coming up, mental health advocates and activists prepare to go to Sacramento on Tuesday to voice their opposition to Governor Gavin Newsom's proposed mental health ballot initiative that would redirect resources and funding from community-based programs for mental health to crisis programs, focusing on the unhoused population.
This is the time where we need those programs and support more than ever, not to take them away. We need to focus on all of our communities, not just one. So if you take from one, you really will deeply impact all of the others. And I know that is not the intention, but that's definitely the impact.
Many Americans who have served time or finished their probation carry the weight of their prior charges with them, making it difficult for them to get ahead in life or maintain consistent employment or housing.
Courts threw it out, but it's still on my records. And every time, like, I go and apply for like a license or something like that, it's there. So I have to prove what kind of person I am.
And a local Alameda artist shares her heart work with the community.
Just a beautiful way for us all to come together. It's been really precious.
I'm Sharon Sabota, and this is the KPFA Weekend Evening News. As many as half of America's unhoused population can be found in California, with well over 115,000 people sleeping outside on any given night. While that number is staggering, the number of Californians struggling or coping with mental health conditions is significantly higher. Some 5.6 million California adults have some type of mental health condition, with as many as one-fifth of those being categorized as severe, and nearly a half a million youth between the ages of 12 and 17 struggling with mental health issues. On Tuesday, mental health advocates, patients, and allies will gather in Sacramento to weigh in on a controversial ballot measure Governor Gavin Newsom is proposing, which could involve a redistribution of funds from intervention programs to programs with crisis response aimed primarily at helping the unhoused population who might also have a mental health struggle. I spoke with Kelechi Ubuzo, author of We've Been Too Patient, Voices from Radical Mental Health, about the intent and potential impact of the proposed ballot measure.
There's going to be an informational session on SB 326, and that is really the Mental Health Service Act modernization. And what the governor is proposing is taking $700 million from prevention and early intervention funds that fund a lot of community-based programs, fund a lot of BIPOC and LGBTQ plus programming and peer support, and focusing it solely on the unhoused community. And what we're advocating for is that you still need a continuum of care. And yes, we do want to serve and support our unhoused communities, but I think California has spent in the past 5 years about $20 billion on trying to fix the homeless problem. And they have not, to my understanding, really included the unhoused community in those conversations or really focused on affordable housing as the solution.
What are some of the community resources that you've been able to tap into on your own journey, caring for your own mental health?
So I moved to California in 2012. After a mental health crisis, I had had a suicide attempt. I had been sexually assaulted. And then I went through like a recovery process. I kind of had these horrible experiences in New York where I was living. I went to Georgia because my mom was there and she wanted to make sure I got really good support. And on my road to recovery, I heard about this thing called peer support. And I'd never heard of peer support. And the peer support is where people who have experienced with trauma or mental health issues or substance use or co-occurring substance use and a mental health issue, they have been through recovery. They have learned and healed. And again, recovery is not a linear process. It's ongoing. Everyone defines it differently. But they use what they've learned to support other people. And that was so different from anything I've ever heard, because when I got into the mental health system as a young person, I was told I was broken. I was told I'd never hold down a job. I was told that I'd be on medication for the rest of my life and that it would be hard for me to have relationships. And I just was told that I would never get better. And these folks, these people, these peers said, no, recovery is possible, healing is possible, we can support you. And I just, that was wild and amazing to me. So I experienced some peer support in Georgia, but then I really heard about California passing this law in 2004 called Prop 63, called the Mental Health Service Act. And essentially this law taxes 1% on anyone who makes over $1 million, which in California is a lot of people. And what used to be essentially the icing on the cake of mental health services, over time, this funding has been the cake.
Is it within the realm of possibility that some of those funds and resources in that specific realm could be taken from to support this other ballot?
Oh, it's not even in the realm. That is exactly what's happening. So I think the reason why so many advocates are so nervous right now is because they might be running like a grassroots community-based organization where Mental Health Service Act is funding a significant amount of their services and supports. And a lot of people say, oh, you know what? We have Medi-Cal billing and we should all move to Medi-Cal billing. And so then you will get reimbursed by the state. But if you're not an organization who has like a clinical supervisor or provider who knows how to bill, I certainly don't know how to bill Medi-Cal, and a lot of peer-run organizations who do not have a formal relationship with a county or do not have a clinician in, you know, on staff will not be doing that and won't have access to that. So Mental Health Service Acts makes it accessible for people who might be grassroots, who might be doing something innovative, who have been doing things for years, for, you know, at this point, it's been like, you know, over a decade of services. We're almost coming up on 20 years, and next year will be 20 years since this has passed. So yeah, I think that's just something to note, is that like what we're really worried about is that the governor's proposing, or at least has been proposing, to take $700 million from prevention and early intervention, from this pot of money, to focus on one population, whereas the Mental Health Service Act has been focused on multiple populations. And so I think we'll have unintended consequences, even though I think the intent is good. I'm deeply concerned about the impact.
Yeah. And I'm going to go back to something you said near the beginning of our interview. You just said if we only focus on the crisis part and not early interventions, we're just going to have more crisis situations. Talk about, from your perspective, how do early interventions actually help so that we avoid a crisis situation?
What folks don't sometimes understand is that I think sometimes when they hear a diagnosis or they hear the language of mental illness, they think that's like a sentence, like that is someone's forever state and experience. But for folks who have experienced trauma, and I'm someone who's experienced trauma, and I did not get good help early on for my support, like for my recovery. What I was told was that I was broken. It was up to me. It was very individualized, and all these really things that made me scared to ever talk to anyone again. It was like, oh, let me hide this and never talk to anyone. But when I did get really good support in my 20s, I was more like, wow, what I needed and what a lot of people need when they're going through a difficult time. Like, you know, we act as if this pandemic is over and everything's fine, but so many people lost, people are moving through grief. Suicides are up for our young people and for our Black and Brown kids. And what we're not really understanding and talking about is that, like, when people have caring adults, when people have early interventions, like learning how to cope with trauma, they are in a better place to deal with other things as they get older. So many people, and again, you don't have to be a young person to get an early intervention, right? You could be on your recovery journey, or like maybe you're in your 30s and, or like even getting close to menopause and other things are happening with your mental health around menopause, for example. If you're able to get peer support, early treatment, resources, to know what's going on and to be the director of your own care, it is so much more impactful for than when you wait or you're trying to go to every door and every door is closed because there's a long line, right? There's like a waiting list for 6 months to get an appointment. That 6 months really impacts people. So having early intervention services, having grassroots free services. I mean, these things are not, you know, these things, a lot of these prevention and early intervention programs are free, and you could drop into a support group and get support and get have other people around you to talk about what's going on. And peer support is also an evidence-based practice that we don't always uplift, is that when you see someone else who's been through what you've been through and they can talk about it openly, it and talk about your recovery journey and what they've done, and also get to understand what are your options, you have such better outcomes than when you're, oh my goodness, we're waiting until a crisis, we're waiting to respond in a crisis. And our system is very crisis focused. Like, people have been trying to get help for months and months and months, and the only door they can go through at some point, because the crisis gets so big, is that they end up having to call 911. And 911 should not be an emergency respondent for like a mental health need that we could have reached months ago through our services, through our programs, through our outreach, through our interventions. So, I mean, we just know that it works, but people see folks unhoused and they see, oh, this is a visible problem. They see folks who may be acting in ways that are different from them and say, oh my goodness, let's attach this to mental illness. And that's what they see. They don't see all of the people who've been intervened on. Like, you don't get to hear those stories. You don't get to hear people's success stories of what has been helpful to them. And I think that is kind of what we're working, you know, I don't want to say working against, because again, we do need services and support for the unhoused community, but more than ever, we need housing for them. And the housing first model, to house someone first, is really what we should be moving to, not let's put them into treatment and give them a bunch of rules. You can't do this, you can't do that. We need harm reduction and we need housing first for those folks.
What would the holistic solution look like that keeps funding those peer-based community grassroots programs and supporting this other vulnerable population? Housing first, yes. And anything else you want to add on to that?
In an ideal world, like a really ideal world, we have voluntary community-based programming that is well-funded. Our mental health services have never been fully funded to take care of everyone. And so sometimes we're kind of like trying to split a piece of pie, but we need a whole continuum. We need things for children. We need things for older adults. We need the entire spectrum of mental health services for every single population. We need to focus on all of our communities, not just one. So if you take from one, you really will deeply impact all of the others. And I know that is not the intention, but that's definitely the impact.
Is there anything else you want to add before we conclude today?
Recovery is really possible. People can heal and get better. And sometimes people see us at our worst. As someone who has lived experience of mental health issues, of trauma, when people see us at our worst, they think that we cannot make decisions for ourselves, or we can't advocate for ourselves, or that we won't ever get better. But really, we need to be able to make our own decisions and be part of the conversation. So when policies happen without us, without the unhoused community, without the Black, Indigenous, people of color folks, without the LGBTQ+ communities, we run into these types of huge issues. When people make decisions without us, and a huge part of our peer and disability rights community statement is nothing about us without us. And this is what happens when it's about us without us, is that you have all of these, oh no, they didn't think about this. They didn't think about this part. So my last statement would really be is to uplift nothing about us without us. We need to be at the table because we understand your programs and what the policy means more than anyone else, as the people who will be firstly impacted by these changes. So we need to be included, and that's what will help heal and come up with solutions that will actually be good for everyone.
That's Kelechi Ubozo, author of We've Been Too Patient, Voices from Radical Mental Health, speaking about Governor Gavin Newsom's proposed mental health ballot initiative. As many as 1 in 3 Americans, or somewhere between 70 and 100 million Americans, have some type of criminal record. These records can result from something as small as a misdemeanor, an arrest, or a petty crime, whether or not a conviction happened, or for probation. Advocates for those impacted by these records say this carceral system that offers no redemption or forgiveness, even for time already served, interferes with everything from job security to housing security and keeps many Americans in a perpetual state of struggle. I recently interviewed a formerly unhoused woman who struggled with addiction stemming from unresolved trauma she experienced in her childhood. She's now running into barriers for time she served on probation a few decades ago.
My name is Julia Ford. I'm 62 years old, and I'm now doing caregiving, and I'm blessed.
Julia Ford lives in Antioch, California, and is an in-home caregiver for an elderly woman in Lafayette. Julia grew up in Oakland and started her professional life as a hairstylist in her early 20s, and imagined being retired by this stage in her life. But she's really just settling in to a role as a caretaker.
I love my job, and I think I love my job because it was the elderly people who helped me when I was a teenager. I didn't hang out with the regular kids. I would go over to the older people's houses, and I would wash their dishes, and they would give me their pop bottles.
It's that sense of indebtedness to the elders that Julia developed as a child that has her wanting to give back to elders who in some cases aren't that much older than she is. But as she tries to obtain licensure to secure her career as a caretaker and give her more opportunities, she runs into some challenges tied to past struggles she's endured, stemming from her efforts to cope with what she describes as an adverse childhood experience from when she was 17 years old.
I have experienced housing insecurity. I remember being homeless. I remember walking around trying to remember what went on inside a home, the normalcy of life. You know, and I would have to remind myself that Mama would always get us up. She would make us brush our teeth, wash our face, you know, and inside the bathroom was our Ten Commandments. So when I thought back to what my old normalcy was, then I would know, but I still would be wondering what went on inside of people's houses, you know. And so I remember even having a car that I had found. I thought it was my car because I lived there.
When you had to remind yourself about the normalcy, was that the part when you were homeless?
Homeless and on drugs.
Do you remember what life was like when you encountered drugs? Like what sort of life struggles were you facing at that time?
It was like being in the wilderness. It was like being with a bunch of animals.
Yeah.
Because you wake up every day, you don't have money, you have to go and graze for food. You know, and I would go through people's garbage and get their cans, bottles, and plastic.
And you already learned that skill as a kid.
Not really. I did know about recycling, but it was a whole different recycling then. And I would say, I don't want your man, I want what's in the trash can. So I was a fun drunk and person that used drugs.
To this day, Julia maintains her cosmetologist license, even though she's not doing hair at the moment. As she looks back, she says it's hard for her to pinpoint the moment in time when she slipped from being a successful hairstylist to someone who slipped into a place of dependency, living on the street.
I think I was on my feet when somebody introduced me to drugs. It wasn't when I was, you know, it was a recreation. We did it recreationally, but I think once you do it and you practice anything, you create a habit for yourself, and then you find yourself, you've walked out of the little box that you were in, and then you begin to meet other people and you find a whole different world.
Yes.
I remember all the other stylists in Oakland saying, is that Julia out there pushing a buggy? I used to push a buggy and I used to recycle.
Do you remember kind of that spot between like recreational experimenting to getting to that point where the buggy came?
I can't tell you when it happened. It just happened, and it happened so fast. They call it the downhill spiral. I had found the recovery home before I got picked up, but I wouldn't go. And so I remember saying that day because my sister had put a ring on my finger. They got me all ready to go. They wanted me to go.
And you wanted it and resisted it, it sounds like.
Yeah, because you don't think it. You start to think if you do 2 or 3 days sober, you don't need it. I don't need somebody to tell me how to stay clean. All I do is stay away from it. But you eventually end up back in that company. And so I ended up back in that company again. Mm-hmm. And something told me, I know it was God, told me to go and get rid of those clothes. Get rid of those clothes. You're gonna need a clear mind.
Because at the time you were like sleeping somewhere on the streets in Oakland.
I was doing all kinds of stuff. I would end up sleeping at somebody's house or sleeping in the back of a bus, like a yellow bus. But it was it had some aluminum on it because I remember they start cutting it to go and recycle sometimes. And so I would sleep there sometimes. Sometimes I would sleep in an abandoned car. And I said, I'm going to go and get those clothes and I'm going to start my life. I said, this is when I'm going to start. And so I went and I convinced him to let me in the house, and as soon as he got comfortable, that's when I jumped up and ran, and I went and threw those clothes in the garbage can. I remember he jumped up trying to fight, and I went around him, because he was disabled too, and I made it around him, and I got all the clothes in the garbage, and by the time the police, because I knew he was going to call the police, I ran down the street, and waited for the police. And by the time the police came and got me in the car, because I surrendered, I remember the garbage company was moving all those garbage cans. And I said, all my clothes are going to be recycled too.
Why was it important for you to get rid of your clothes? Why not just leave them?
They were like skeletons in my mind.
And you needed that gone.
I needed that gone. I needed to get rid of all those connections. You know, all those clothes had been in all these different rooms. I started thinking about all the places I've been and everything, and I wanted to get that off of my mind.
Julia's then-boyfriend called the police on her the night she took and threw away all of her belongings. Although the charges were ultimately dropped, she was put on probation for 24 months. Even though the probationary period ended nearly half a lifetime ago for Julia, that experience continues to show up and haunt her as a blip on her record today.
Courts threw it out, but it's still on my records. And every time, like, I go and apply for, like, a license or something like that, it's there. So I have to prove what kind of person I am.
Although life's been anything but easy for Julia, who is now the mother of 4 grown-up children and some stepchildren, she says she's always believed in something bigger than herself.
Even out on the streets, I believed in something bigger than myself. I used to play Miss Marianne. For the kids, I would always worry about other people's kids because I didn't have mines, you know. And then when I got the chance to get mines, I didn't think my kids were going to respect me. So at first I didn't run and go get my kids until it took Miss Majida Rothman, who was a former Black Panther, and she had Healthy Baby Project. It took her to tell me, you go get your baby. And, you know, as I begin to clean up my life, they give you suggestions on how to do it. You know, how to clean it up. And it's a scraping because you have all these issues when you first get in recovery. And you also have issues that ran you out there. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember scraping all the way up until I was 17 years old. I got raped. Mm-hmm. And I didn't tell anybody about it.
And were you able to lean on anybody at home, or was the shame what kept you quiet?
It was shame. Yeah, it was shame for me. And I think that's what really did it to me and why I began to use drugs, is because I was covering that up. And one of the reasons why I didn't tell somebody is because I had a little brother, and I think my brother would have probably harmed the guy that did it to me. You know, I know he would have. And so I kind of tried to cover it up, but it ended up hurting me. Try to put those feelings away. And some kind of way, they end up hurting you. Mm-hmm. You know, they end up showing up. But like if you use drugs or something, it's just like a cover-up. You know, you might cover up those feelings. And that's why I like recovery. Recovery.
Like uncovering.
You're uncovering the things that may have hurt you.
That's Julia Ford, an in-home caregiver, speaking about the challenges of having been on probation a few decades ago. If you or someone you know is experiencing challenges and setbacks for time already served, or you want to learn more about how to help, you can visit cleanslateinitiative.org. Deirdre Freeman is part of a collective of artists who gathers in Alameda each Friday to share art with the community in a free and accessible way, meant to meet people where they are in life, no matter what age or stage they're at, or no matter what their socioeconomic situation may be. Freeman, a self-taught artist, aims to provide her community with heartwork, art that comes from the heart. For the next 3 Fridays, Freeman's work is being shown at the Red Door Gallery in Alameda from 7 to 10 p.m. I spoke to Freeman ahead of her show during the Alameda Art Fair.
I'm an acrylic painter and I paint heartwork, which is very inspiring, happy, loving, healing art. And I have one piece in the gallery today for $99.
I love it because everything here is under
$100. Yes, everything is.
What does heartwork mean to you?
Oh, it just means that the things that I create come from a really deep place in my heart and my soul. And I just thought it was a cute play on words. Not an original one, but I like it nonetheless.
And why do you think it's important to have spaces like this, where there's just art up in the middle of the community that's accessible to everybody? Whether or not they buy it, they can at least come by and appreciate it, right?
Yeah, I think this is bringing a lot of community together today. I see people walking by on the other side of the street and just kind of saying to themselves, what's going on here? This is amazing. And there are a lot of people who are here today who are not artists, who are getting a chance to see what the artists around here do. And it's just a beautiful way for us all to come together. It's been really precious.
Yeah, I feel like I've seen people of all walks of life, people unhoused, all the way across the socioeconomic spectrum.
Yeah.
What's the most important lesson you've learned on your journey doing art on your in your life and in this community?
I think in my life, I would say that the most important lesson has been to just be myself and to accept myself for who I am. I'm a self-taught artist, so I have basically just, you know, come to be this artist all on my own, and I'm proud of that, and it really does speak to who I am as a person. And then in the community, I really like reaching out to the community. I did a project over COVID where I put up over 300 art pieces on telephone poles and left them for people to find. And I like doing things like that are kind of outreach and anonymous.
What kind of response did you get from that?
Oh, people loved it. People knew it was me because of the style of the little paintings I put up. Most people knew it was me. I think people liked it a lot, especially since that was such a hard time for everybody. It was something nice that people could go for a walk and find something on their neighborhood telephone pole.
And what did it do for you?
It did a lot for me. It gave me something to do over the pandemic. I wasn't working at the time, so I kind of looked at that as my job. And I created each piece individually. There were no pieces that were duplicates of one another. It was just really a beautiful way to give back to the community. And it was a very loving and healing thing for me to do too.
The Red Door Gallery, which is now showing Freeman's work, is open from 7 to 10 p.m. on Fridays and is located at 2309 Incidental Avenue in Alameda. Entrance is free. That's it for this evening's news. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. I'll be back with you again the third Sunday of next month. Until then, take care. I'm Sharon Sabota. Good evening.